Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, if you went to the Central Coast and ran into him on the street near his home in Cayucas, you'd have no idea what he's been through.
We'd always have a prayer, and we'd wind up with the Lord's Prayer. I never did even think that I wasn't going to make it because of my faith in God. And I knew he was going to take care of me.
Catch this prisoner of war and death march survivor on Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9. Brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, a show where each time we visit with veterans of World War II, the idea to honor them for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. Boy, are we in for one today in terms of going through things we can't even imagine. And of course, we also, along the way, are educated and inspired as we listen to people that if you saw them walking down the street, you might not have any idea what they've been through. That's certainly the case today. His hometown now is Cayucas. Originally, he's from Paso Robles, California. Carl Heuser, our guest, 91 years old now. But let's go way back when you were just the little kid running around Paso Robles, the son of the Lutheran minister. What was life like in Paso? A little different than now, I suppose.
Very plain, very comfortable, nothing out of the ordinary, just run-of-the-mill.
All of our cities in Central California have undergone some transformation over the years, but Paso Robles now, the first thing people think are all the glittering wineries along the road. None of those were there then, huh?
When I left Paso Robles, the population was about 7,500. It had been that way for years. And I was active as I was at the bank there, and I was active in the Red Cross and the city and so forth. In fact, I was treasurer of the Red Cross for a long time over there. But it was just a plain, ordinary little town.
So you've seen the changes, and you were part of getting the Warbirds Museum there going, a founding member of that museum. The air show's coming up October 5th for those of you who want to see a P-51 and some other great vintage airplanes up in the sky. What was the moment for you that the idea of flying grabbed a hold of you? Because I can tell just walking into your room here and seeing all the posters of great airplanes on the wall that you love flying.
I had a dream of flying. One day there was an outfit that came to Sherwood Field, the observation group, and one of their sergeants was a member who came to our church. And one day he called me up at work and he says, "Can you come out here in your lunch hour?" I said, "Yeah." And he says, "What do you got?" I said, "I got something to show you." So I went out there, and he put me in his Jeep and took me out to a P-40. The first combat or anything close to a combat plane that I had ever seen. He let me sit in the cockpit, and the smell and the feel, I said, "This is what I got to do." That's why I decided right then that I was going to go into, when the time came, I was going to go into pilot training.
How old were you at that time?
I was 21, just barely 21. I had to get my parents' approval to enlist in the Air Corps, which I enlisted in Santa Maria as an aviation cadet.
Every veteran that I interview, I ask about December 7th because everybody seems to have some specific memory of that day and how that news came through. So how did you find out that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
As I said, my father was a pastor, and we always had several soldiers because they were already coming to Camp Roberts. But we had several soldiers at our house for dinner after church listening to the radio. And we were sitting at the table having dinner, and the radio came on. And it's special. And it announces that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. Forgive me, but my brother-in-law was there. He was a major in the artillery. And he got up and he says, "Gentlemen, let's go." Took him back to the base. I'll never forget that because it was so, it just hit everybody this different way. But it just hit home, boom, they've attacked us. We had never had that before.
The reason that I ask everyone that question is because everyone has a memory, and I haven't heard that twist on it. I mean, that, if anything, makes it real for you. It's to see military men in the same room you are in and seeing what they have to do. Did you have an inkling, even at that age, that you probably would be in the military at some point?
Because of my age, I knew I was subject to the draft. So I had, if you enlisted in something like I was going to, then they wouldn't call you, but you had to be enlisted. So that was August of 42, just 8 months after the Pearl Harbor, that I enlisted in the Army Air Corps. Went down to Santa Maria and enlisted. Had to get my folks to approve, and they didn't want to approve, but my mom finally says, "This is what he wants to let it do."
I'm guessing that you did that, enlisted in the Army Air Corps, because you weren't thinking, "Hey, I'm going to be a tail gunner." You were thinking, "Hey, I'm going to be a pilot."
I saw those poor guys out at Camp Roberts doing all that marching. And Camp Roberts, it was hot. They're in hell out there at Camp Roberts. And they were doing this. And I said, that's not for me. I want to make sure I didn't get in the infantry. So that's another reason I wanted to enlist. But you know, the strange part about that is that after I was a prisoner of war at the end of my term, we walked for 3 months. We walked over 500 miles around Germany. So I had plenty of walking time.
Yeah, we're going to get to that German death march, as it's been called, for those of you who were at Stalag Luft 4. First, we got to get the rest of the story of what you did in the Air Corps, how you got shot down to begin with. How far did you make it in terms of your dream of becoming a pilot at that point?
Shipped out to Thunderbird, outside of Scottsdale. And there we flew the PT-17, the Sturman biplane, PT, the primary trainer. I finished there. I was a hot pilot. And they sent us to Minterfield at Shafter over by Bakersfield. And there we flew the BT-13, the vicious faulty vibrator, we called it. And I had just sold it, and I had about 12 hours. And one morning, our instructor, we always had to meet with our instructor, he says, Hacker and Heuser, report to cadet headquarters. And I said, what for? He says, report to cadet headquarters. So I reported to headquarters, and I said, what am I doing here? The sergeant says, come follow me. I went into a room, and there was a desk of officers, and they said, you're being eliminated, and that's all. And I said, why? Don't ask any questions. Just answer our questions. Have you been treated fairly here? No. You have three choices. You also qualify to go to Bombardier School. So you can go to Bombardier School. Number two, you can go home, give up your enlistment, and go home and be subject to the draft. Or you can do what we want you to do. We can go to a gunnery school. So I said, I'll go to gunnery school. So that's how I got started. So then I went to Las Vegas Army Air Base for gunnery school, which was fun. I mean, that was thrilling. It was a lot of fun. I went home, and I came back and went to South Carolina and was assigned to this group that I was assigned to. So we flew overseas and landed up with the 410th Bomb Group at close to Chelmsford in England.
When they called Janet Minter and gave you that news, was that hard for you to swallow? Was that a tough one for you emotionally?
That was really tough because I really wanted to be a pilot. That was, you know, in the Army, you don't question it. You just they say, yes, sir, no, sir. You just take it the way that it comes in. And that was, you know, I was not a very mature kid. I was just a youngster. I had to take it just the way it came. I was not very unhappy with it. I didn't cry about it, but I was very unhappy because I really wanted to be a pilot. And I knew I could fly. I knew I was a good pilot. So then we went to England. I flew 10 and a half missions.
Well, and the planes that you flew them in, I thought I had talked to someone from at least every plane that our military had, but I don't think I've ever interviewed someone who was in an A-20 on actual combat missions, and some people just said A-20. What is he talking about, an A-20? So why don't you first explain to us what an A-20 is, and then what your duties on the A-20 were.
The A-20 was designed first by Douglas. It was built by Douglas. It was first designed as a dive bomber, and its first designation was DB-7. Dive Bomber 7. It was built for that purpose. However, when the first A-20s were shipped to France, really, and then when France was occupied, then they sent them to Britain, and the Britain called it the Havoc. We call it the Havoc. They call it the Boston. They had a number of them. In fact, a bit of trivia. The very first all-American bomber flight over Europe was made by A-20s. British A-20s, but flown by American crews and flew over an airfield in the Netherlands. And that was on July the 4th, 42. And the A-20 was a fast twin-engine light bomber. We carried 400 or 500-pound bombs. Later, they modified and they could carry two more 500-pounders under the wings. But it was really not a major threat. It could be used to fit in where the big planes couldn't do it, or the little, it could fit in. So it was sort of a useful plane for that reason.
As far as your role on the plane, I'm looking at the model of an A-20. In fact, even with your nose markings, Mopsy, up there. And I only see one gun turret that is about two-thirds of the way back on the airplane. Is that where you were?
That was my position. I was in the turret, what they call the belly, the opening in the bottom of the plane. The gunner that was down there, he had one single caliber 50 that he could swing into place and use. But normally he was taking pictures. And he would wear his flak suit. And he was, in fact, when we got shot up, that's what saved his life, was the flak suit. And the camera was just blown out of his hand. So he and I bailed out together. The whole empennage, I've got pictures of the whole empennage of our airplane was shot off by the German aircraft. The pictures right out of the center of the squadron.
Yeah, and any of these pictures that are relevant, we'll put online on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. That one sounds like a spectacular one. Can't wait to see it. So the A-20, how many men would have been in that crew?
The A-20 carried a crew of three. The pilot, he was all by himself up front. The pilot in the A-20 did everything. He was a radio man. He was a bombardier. He was a gunner. He did everything he had to do. And he was sitting out there in front of the props. And our plane was shot down. He didn't have a chance to get out. He was killed in the plane crash. And the bottom guy was, like I said, was a photographer. And I was in the turret, and I was just, so you know, looking for airplanes. Never did fire a shot. Wow. Never fired a shot.
And, you know, I've talked to a lot of guys on a lot of bomber crews, but most of those guys are on B-17s or B-24s or B-29s, and a lot bigger crews than just three. Do I assume that since you were such a small crew that you guys were pretty close to each other, or did you bounce around from different pilots?
No, we flew with the same crew always. The pilots sort of kept to themselves, and as good as we kept ourselves. We didn't associate with them socially at all. We were a tight crew. I mean, we'd eat at the mess together. Before we went overseas, our pilot that we had, we were down in Oklahoma, he invited his wife. His wife was a 4-4 Caddo Indian, and she cooked dinner for us, and we had dinner with him.
Did he have the honor of naming your plane Mopsy, or had that happened before you guys got it?
The plane was honored Mopsy because of the three letters that designated our airplane, like the 5D, that's the squadron. And then and every airplane then had a difference. So ours was M, and the crew chief, that he named it Mopsy. So it was his airplane, because we never knew which airplane we were going to fly, usually. But sometimes we did, but sometimes we didn't.
That was the one you guys were shot down in, but not the one you flew for all your missions. Tell me about your first mission. When you get up in an A-20 for the first time, and you see things that you probably never seen before, what was that first mission like for you?
That's a good question, because it was, as we first arrived at the group, we were new, and we would talk to the guys over there, and they say, "What's it like?" They look at it and say, "We can't tell you. You have to experience it. We can't tell you what it's like." And so when we I remember the first mission that we went on, we were flying the last plane in this young squadron, and we were shot up pretty bad. We had over 30 holes in the plane all around. My parachute just got blown out, but we were shot up pretty bad. So then I said, when we got back, they said, "Now do you know what it's like?" "Yeah, I got a pretty good idea." You're sitting up there, and you're looking around, and you don't see anything. And then all of a sudden, you hear the bombs. You feel the plane jerk when the bombs go away, and you turn around, going. We had a fast airplane. We would go to the target at about 280, 270. When they turned around and started going home with them, it was more like 320. Just put the nose in, let's go home. And like I said, I never saw an enemy airplane to shoot at, and I never fired a round of ammunition. Other than practice, we'd go out and shoot at that thing on the ground. But otherwise, I never shot at an airplane.
You fly 10 missions as a gunner on this three-man crew of an A-20 at the 410th Bomb Group. And then they need volunteers for a mission. How did this 11th mission come around? What were you supposed to be doing that day?
Every day they had what they called the loading list. That was the crews that were supposed to be flying the next mission. Our crew was not on the loading list, but some guy comes tearing back in the Jeep and says, "Hey, we need a volunteer. Need a turret gunner." And I said, I'll go. I was bound and determined to get as much done as I could so I could get the hell home as fast as I could. We had to fly, our airplane had to fly 65 missions before you were able to go home. None of our guys ever made that many. I mean, they made them, but they never got to go home. But where like the heavies, the B-20s, the B-24s and the B-17s, they flew 25 missions, and then they could go home. And a lot of those guys did, like the Memphis Belle, you've heard about. They went home. We didn't have any guys leaving or going home.
So you're trying to get as many missions as you can, as soon as you can, so you volunteer, but then you're flying with a pilot you've never flown before?
I never flew with him before, and I knew the gunner because we sit across the table I knew who he was. But I didn't really know him that well because he was a separate crew. So when I volunteered, he and I spent some time together. In fact, after the war, we saw each other quite a bit, you know, at the various reunions and whatnot. But he and I bailed out. But funny thing, when he bailed out, we were at about 10,500 feet when the ship got hit up. The whole empennage, I mean, the whole tail end was, you know, it's just a great big hole there. And here we are. And I had to get out of my turret, unbuckle myself, and put on my chute on my harness and get out. And he had already gone out. And I went out, and I was tumbling, and it's the first time, and you never know, you just can't imagine what it's like. You're just tumbling, you can't see hell or high water, and all of a sudden I said, "That's not good." So I spread eagled myself, and I started falling. I could see the ground, and I could see the sky, and I'm looking around. I said, "Where in the hell is Herman?" And finally, I opened my parachute. I said, "This is enough." I opened my parachute. He was way up. He pulled his parachute as soon as he got out of the airplane. But they had told us to delay opening your chute as long as you're safe, as long as you feel safe. Because the better chance you have of escaping capture, the less time you spend in the sky. So, anyhow, but that was quite an experience. When that chute opens, it really tears. You really stop. You're flying at about terminal velocity at about 125 miles an hour, And that slows you down to about 20 miles an hour. I mean, it really jerks. It hits hard.
Well, I imagine so, physically and emotionally. We definitely need to explore that moment a little more before we get to your capture, your time as a POW, your surviving the death march. But right now, it's time for a break. 91-year-old Carl Heuser of Cayucas, California, is our guest today. We'll get the rest of his story when we come back. And hey, if you're looking for something to do this weekend and you really enjoy patriotic music, the Sounds of Freedom Band, great friends of mine, they're having a Best of the Summer concert, 2 p.m. Sunday, September 15th. 2 p.m. Sunday, September 15th. It's at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building in beautiful Old Town Clovis. It's absolutely free, so enjoy. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Carl Heuser of Cayucas, California, originally from Paso Robles. And on August 4th, 1944, he was in Gosfield, England, where he volunteered to take the place of a sick turret gunner and fly that day as part of a three-man A-20 crew with the 644th Squadron, 410th Bomb Group. What a fateful decision that was. You heard Carl describe the jolt when he pulled his parachute while bailing out that day. But I really want to understand, and I want our listeners to understand, what this whole experience was like. So let's explore a little more, if we can.
How you guys got hit. I'm assuming it was anti-aircraft artillery that got you. Did you know it was coming, or were you guys just blindsided? How'd that happen?
You could see and smell the bursting of the anti-aircraft shells. And you could smell it, but you just kept right on flying. The German anti-aircraft was very accurate at our level. We were only about 10 or 11,000 feet, and very accurate there. And we lost a lot of planes because of that. But because we had to fly that level so that our bombing was more accurate. And we were bombing bridges and railroads and things like this, and troops. But we didn't bomb the factories like the heavies did. They bombed all the strategic factories, the ball bearing factories. But we would bomb bridges and railroads and things like that. Bomb dumps. That about from about 10,000. But when we got rid of those bombs, we turned around and go, oh, yeah. I mean, we went home in a hurry. It was always across the channel. There was nothing ahead of time to warn us. I mean, it just, we knew that there was, you could see them, and you'd fly right through them. The bursts of the black smoke. You'd fly right through it, but sooner or later there would be one for you. And sure enough, it just picked us right out of the center of the squadron, just took the whole tail off of our airplane. And like I said, the gunner down with Fred, who was down below, he had his camera, and the camera was just blown out of his head. But that's what kept him from getting killed. Otherwise, that blast would have killed him. His flak suit looked like somebody had taken a shotgun about 5 feet away and just shot at him. My, I was in pretty good shape when I got there. I was not wounded, but like I said, I spent as little time as I could in the air. But the Germans were there waiting for me when I came down. They were right there on the ground. The same people that shot us down, by the way. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, they were pretty proud of us. They marched us into town. They let us keep our shoes on, but they took all the rest of our paraphernalia off, all the military stuff, and took that off.
So you and the gunner landed somewhere near the same spot?
He landed about 2 miles from where I did, because he was high, he was up higher. The wind blew him that way. But I landed. I came right down in the middle of where the anti-aircraft battery was, the camp. I was right close to that. I came right down there. But then they brought us together, and they marched. They didn't, the German officer that came had a motorcycle. We didn't see any trucks until later on after they captured us. This is kind of funny. They put us into the basement of a home and took all of our clothes off. Everybody took us stark naked, and then they marched us upstairs to stand in front of this officer's desk. He was going to interrogate us. And here I'm standing there stark naked, and this guy's playing with my .45, my gun. And I knew it was loaded. I had a shell in the chamber. And I'm telling him, you stupid so-and-so, that gun is loaded. You better let me take care of it. And the guards are poking me in the back with their rifles. The adrenaline was really flowing because I didn't have any fear at all about hurting him. But I had to tell him. So he finally handed me my 45 and let me take it apart. And I took all the shells out of it and put it back on the desk. that was a funny thing.
What was going through your mind as you floated down to the ground, got captured, get taken to be interrogated, all that? I mean, I'm sure you never expected to be in that situation. So what was it like when you were? Were you just kind of shocked? What were you feeling?
You thought about what you did when certain things would happen. You always had to sort of presuppose things and so on. But I had never thought about what would happen if I got shot down. I was not going to get shot down. So there it comes, and I'm doing it. And I can only remember very vaguely the thoughts that went through my head. I said, damn it, the war's over for you. You're not going home after any 65 missions. Then, of course, I could also say that I was glad to be alive. I got a good story to tell you. In prison camp, in our camp, we were all in bed. There was a lot, just oodles of us. There were over 8,000 of us in Soligotor. And we'd go out and have a parade every day. Every morning I had a parade. As soon as we'd get up, they'd count us. The Germans could only count by fives, so we had to line up by fives. So they had given us a parcel when we got for it. Had a sweater in it and some shorts and socks and toothpaste and so on. And anyhow, I had had a box of a can of brown shoe polish. I wonder why they wanted us to shoe polish. And now, we had a guy in our room, his name was Beatty. And Beatty came from Tonawanda, New York, and he was always telling stories. He was funnier than hell. Anyhow, he went around to everybody and convinced them all to paint a brown Hitler mustache with that shoe polish. And our whole barracks did that. Well, we fell out as usual, and the German guard did not know how to handle this. They run back and forth. Usually this would take about 5 or 10 minutes. It took us 20 minutes. They said, stay right here. And then they went, the commandant, our commandant came. And he said, what's the matter? And he laughed. Anyhow, they said, go back to your barracks. So the German guards then went to the barracks, and they convinced the commandant, the German commandant. We had heard good feelings about him. He had been an ME-109 pilot shot down in Africa and been sent to America for medical treatment, and he was back again. He was a tall guy, very imposing. I mean, he was a real typical, if you want to say a typical German officer, this was him. So he came in, and here we're lined up again, all with our mustaches. And I still think I saw a smile on his face. But he's told you. But anyhow, they chatted for about 5 or 10 minutes. Okay, everybody back there. But no more facial paintings. No more face paintings. Okay, so we won't paint any more Hitler mustaches on. That was funny. We had to make our own fun.
Well, yeah, you had to make your own a lot of things, from what I understand from all the POWs I've interviewed. How difficult was it to be in those conditions, whether it was the weather, the lack of proper food, the uncertainty of the whole thing, not knowing when you're ever going to get out of there? How did you deal with all of that?
Everybody had their own feelings about what was going to happen to them. We didn't know, we didn't have any idea how the Germans were going to treat us or mistreat us. We were all apprehensive. We thought, well, you know, they could mistreat us. But they did not mistreat us. The only thing they didn't do, they didn't feed us. But they did not mistreat us.
No, and you were there for a while, all the way until February 1945, when they marched you out of there to avoid the incoming Russians.
We were the last people to get out, I think, really. And it was snow. It was one of the worst winters they'd had back there. And we took our blankets, so that's all we had. Sleep three together. And I had had a blood poisoning on my foot. I stepped on a piece of glass, and I got an infection in my foot. And that foot was still... It was healing because the doctor had healed it up, but it was still warm from fever. And everybody that put their feet, all their feet against my one foot to keep their feet warm when we sleep. We slept on the snow many times at night, and you did a lot of rolling around. You didn't sleep an awful lot. But then the next morning you get up and you get going again. The Germans had dogs that they had. It was pretty quick. Their dogs were all of our good friends. We could pet them and stuff. That march, almost 3 months, 88 days we marched. We would go from town to town. Some days we'd march 30 kilometers. Some days we'd march 5 kilometers. They just did not know what to do with us except to keep us away from the Russians. That was their main, because they were scared stiff of the Russians for good reason. You know, the Russians were entirely different kind of soldiers than the Germans were. As I said, the Germans did not abuse us. They just didn't feed us.
Let's expound on that for a minute if you can, because some people who've heard this show and heard other POWs might have an idea of what that was like. But let me just ask you a few questions. How much do you think you weighed when you were captured?
Less than 100 pounds. I must have weighed maybe close to, I had my regular weight at that time about 145 pounds. And I know my belt was, I could tell, not my belt, probably weighed about 90 pounds when I was liberated. We lost a lot of weight.
Well, and for you, a lot of that was due to the march too, but just in the camp itself, I'm sure you started losing weight. What all did they feed you? Are we talking about the infamous bread you need a power saw to cut through, or what were you eating?
The German rations in camp with a bucket full of potatoes per room, and they had to be scraped, not peeled. They had to be scraped, and then they would go back and cook them, and then get them back in for lunch. And a bucket full of potatoes and a piece of, like, pumpernickel bread, about maybe an inch and a quarter thick, and a pat of butter on top of that. And that was the German ration. That's what the Germans gave us. We had Red Cross parcels, and they would dole them out to us as they wanted to. But that was what I saved it, because we would get, every day we get a different can. You had to turn in, if you turned in 20 cans, if you got 20, you had to turn in 20 cans, so you couldn't keep any cans. So, but every day was a little bit something different. Red Cross parcels were very, very helpful. That's why some people don't like the Red Cross too much, but they were the people that got that stuff to us. So, I remember I wrote a letter to Ann Landers, because she had taken on the Red Cross for some reason. I said, don't forget what they did for us. They were the ones that got it to us. That was important.
And I've heard some stories over the years, different things that guys did with some of those cans or materials they'd get from the Red Cross, and pretty improvisational ways that they used different materials, whatever they could get their hands on. Do you think back on anything you saw in your camp, whether you made or someone else made, that you never would have thought of that?
After the camp froze over, this is December now, and the big parade ground is all frozen over, the Germans had poured water on it. So the guys would take the skin from a Klim can and try to make skis, trying to put, not skis, but skates on their shoes, and they were falling and tumbling around out there. It was kind of funny to watch, because nobody was going to make a pair of skates out of a tin can, but they tried. Oh, I'm sure the Germans were eating very well too, because they were eating our parcels also, and they had thousands of them. They had tons of them.
Did you hear from home at all? Did they hear from you at all?
We were given two letters and four postcards every month to write. I never got anything from them. I think very few of the guys in our camp got any mail back. That was hard. Now, remember, it was August the 4th when I was shot down. Excuse me. My parents probably had a letter or two after that, but they did not know what happened to me until January. I was there. I wasn't even thinking about that. But when I got home, I thought, boy, that was a long time not to know anything. I've still got the cables from the government.
And I want to understand what life was like in that camp. And like you said, everyone had a little different perspective there. But when you look back at the time you spent in captivity, do you see something that helped you get through that? Was there something about your mindset, your faith, your confidence? How did you survive all that in the face of so many things that would make people want to give up?
We supported each other. I think that's the prime feature of this. When we saw a guy starting to get a little bit, he's on his way, we would gather up together and take care of him. We'd walk with him. We would give him extra, some of our food, if necessary. But anyhow, we were going to make damn sure that nobody in our care went off the deep end. And I think we all knew that we were going to win the war. We knew we were going to, it doesn't matter when. We all knew that we just had to do what we had to do to stay alive, to stay there. Like I said, it was just making sure that nothing happened to me, because nothing's going to happen to you.
How did you guys, inside your camp, keep up with what was going on outside your camp? Did you have any idea of how close the end of the war was getting?
We had a logger. There were four loggers. The first logger was made up with mostly the British troops, and the British had a radio. They would call it the Gash. Every day, somebody from the British compound would go up to on sick call, and then he would spread the Gash to the guys. The German guard were not there was not enough of them to take care of, so we had plenty of room there. And only you see the doctors were our American surgeons, American flight surgeons. They would tell the guy, and then this guy would come back to his logger and go from barracks to barracks and tell them what yesterday's news was. And so we knew the pretty what was going on in the war, because we had the British had, they had bamboozled a German guard to bring him the pieces they had to. If you'd ask a German guard for a match and he gave him a match, you had something on him. He was not supposed to give you that match. So you had something on him, and you said, I'm going to tell. And so they were very careful. But it was funny in that way. You could bribe them with food or cigarettes. They liked our cigarettes, but they had more of our cigarettes than we did.
And you already referenced the march, the infamous march, the march that claimed a lot of lives, thankfully not yours. How did that come about? I'm sure you weren't expected to be taken out of your barracks and marched halfway across the continent.
As I said, our camp was up in Poland, and the Russians were coming close. The Russians were coming from the east towards the west, and the Germans had no right, no use at all for the Russians. They were scared stiff of the Russians. And so they, as I said, they marched us out 1,000 a day, and We were one of the last groups that went out there, but they gave us a parcel of food to take with us, and we had our blankets and so forth, and we just had to go as we went. And like I said, it was the first part of February, and this is one of the worst winters that they had had in Northern Europe, and it was a bitter winter, bitter cold. And three of us would gather together, and we would just hug each other to try to stay warm at night. As we went on and the weather got better, then we began to read each other's shirt sleeves and so forth for lice. We had lice, and we had the same clothes on for 3 months. We didn't change anything. A lot of us had dysentery, and our pants were dirty, and we couldn't do a thing about it. We had to keep on going. And we had GI shoes, and that's one thing that I had to. I traded my GI shoes with a Moroccan kid. He was in the next compound, and we talked to him, and he said he would give me a can of Spam to trade my shoes. He had British shoes. So he threw his shoe over one of his, I threw my shoe over, and then he threw me a can of Spam over and threw another shoe. So I had a can of Spam and his shoes. His shoes had hobnails in the heels. They were well made. They were British. They were well made. But, oh, talking about miserable hawk talking with, instead of rubber, hobnails on your heels. So I had to wear those for the last month or so that I had. My feet were pretty well tired.
And on that march, and I don't know if people can really fathom marching for that long and for that many miles. I'm sure there were guys that were getting weak and couldn't keep up. What happened to someone who just couldn't keep going?
Occasionally, and this only happened, I would say, 12, 15 times. If a guy had to fall out of the formation, a guard had to go with him. And very often, you'd hear a one shot and the guard would come back alone. Because the guy he couldn't make it anymore, the guard knew it, he knew it, and they just leave him there. They would when we get to a little town, if they had some people that were sick, we talk to the German guards and tell them, and they would try to make arrangements there to have someone look after you in the little town. So several of our guys bailed out that way. They stayed in the little town where the Germans were taking medical care of them.
What a desperate situation you found yourself in. And you know, I think this a lot during these programs, if I don't always verbalize it, but I think I will here. I absolutely cannot imagine what that must have felt like. I know people have asked you plenty over the years, I'm sure, Carl, about the possibility of escape. So let's talk about that when we come back. Carl Heuser of Cayucas is our guest today. We'll get the rest of his incredible and emotional story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. The average age of the veterans on this program is pretty close to 90, so I've seen firsthand over the years the challenges of aging, and I've realized that everybody approaches them a little differently. For some, a friendly senior living community is the ideal option, but for many of us, there's no place like home. I don't have any ruby slippers for you, but I do have an idea. Call Jason Selsler at 317 Construction, recognized by the National Association of Home Builders as a certified age-in-place specialist. Instead of giving up the comforts of home, why not let 317 Construction make your home more comfortable by making it more accessible? Jason and his crew can widen doorways, install ramps for wheelchairs or scooters, reconfigure your counters for better access, modify your shower for safety, secure grab bars wherever you need them, whatever it takes to allow you and your family to keep making your memories in the place that holds so many of them, your home sweet home. Call 905-8490. That's 559-905-8490. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkernCounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, CVHonorFlight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes as we learn about the German Death March of 1945 from a man who survived it, Carl Heuser of Cayucas.
We've actually had two other survivors of that march on this program over the years, and I got to spend some good time with another one of them this past week. Rudy Giannone joined me at CBMC Fresno to spread the word about Central Valley Honor Flight. Rudy and Carl actually met each other years ago, randomly, in Cayucas, and they realized they had both been through this same death-defying experience in World War II. How about that? Speaking of Honor Flight, it has been a pretty exciting week on that front. From a group of Rainbow Girls in Clovis raising $286, thanks girls, to help send veterans to their memorial in Washington, D.C., to the Farney Automotive Group in Selma committing $8,000 for the cause, and now the Clovis Veterans Memorial District is stepping up to launch 14 veterans from within the district boundaries on our inaugural flight next month. The wave of support for Central Valley Honor Flight is absolutely building, and I'm really excited about it. I'm excited it's going so strong in Kern County, too. And how about the special event coming up September 24th in Lemoore? Yeah, right there in Lemoore in Kings County. So for those of you listening on KVEC on the Central Coast or KNZR in Kern County, it could be a little shorter drive for you than all the way to Fresno. Tuesday, September 24th at the Golden Eagle Arena at West Hills College in Lemoore, Congressman David Valadeo will be there as a guest speaker. A couple veterans who have been on Honor Flights will talk, and we'll be showing the award-winning Honor Flight documentary. It's a really, really powerful film that underscores just how worthwhile this mission of sending our vets to their memorial is. If you enjoy Hometown Heroes, I know you're going to love the film Honor Flight, so I hope we'll see you there. Speaking of films, as we get back to Carl Heuser here, the definitive World War II prisoner of war film, of course, is The Great Escape. An awesome cast, incredible plot, funny movie too, and there's a great scene where one of the characters has the passionate line about, "It is the sworn duty of all officers to try to escape." So all those months in the camp, then on the march, Carl, did you ever think about trying to escape?
The Americans told us, your duty is to escape. And we said, you tell me my duty is to escape. I can see myself a solid citizen walking down the street in a uniform, a German, U.S. uniform, walking down a German street. No way. You're going to get shot and killed immediately. So we knew it was our duty to escape, but nobody was going to try to escape. That would have been foolish. It would have been foolish. And we admitted that.
You talked about people that couldn't keep going and what the German guards would do, and then others would get medical attention and so forth. Were there ever moments where you wondered if you could keep going, where you thought you were about at your last ounce of strength?
No. And the reason is my faith in God. I prayed. In fact, I was the leader of our little group, and I would pray. When we'd get started, we'd always have a prayer, and we'd wind up with the Lord's Prayer. And I never did even think that I wasn't going to make it because of my faith in God. And I knew He was going to take care of me.
Well, and obviously He did, and I think everyone listening appreciates how powerful that reality is for you, especially looking back now. I don't want to dwell on this too long, but just so we understand how brutal this march was.
The cold, for one thing. You told me that you would come to a farmhouse and see a big old pile of manure, stinky manure, and stick your feet in the pile of manure because you knew it was warm?
And we could also do the same thing with food. Put it in there to get it warm if we had it, and you'd pull it out and you'd eat it. I mean, it didn't matter that it had been in a pile of manure. It was something to eat, and food was so, there was nothing, absolutely nothing thrown away. It was just, you'd eat everything you could and then some. Whenever we get to, when we were brought down into smaller groups, and towards the end of the war, we maybe 200 or 250 of us, the Germans would put us into a barn, and we would sneak out, and we'd raise a big carcass over here, so all the guards had to go over there, and then these guys would go out and find a couple of chickens and kill the chickens, and we'd build a little fire in the barn, build a little fire and cook the chickens. And you know, it was very ingenious the way they may do like that if they could. If you could find a chicken, then there was got to be eggs, so you look for the eggs. I remember I got shot at. All the farmers had a basement where they kept their beets and their other things that were done underground. And I had made a dash out there, and I was coming back, and I had my arm full of beets, sugar beets. I got shot at. And I could hear the bullet.
Could you tell when you were getting toward the end of that march? Did you sense freedom beckoning? What do you remember about those last moments of the march and how great it felt to be free again?
The guards were getting closer and closer to us. They were telling us their names, and they knew they were going to be prisoners also. So they were telling us their name, and they said, in a way, you know, please take care of me. The only guard we had one guy, his name was Big Snoop. He had to be 7 feet tall, and he'd just pick you up by your hair and pick you up. He was mean. He got chopped up with axes, and he was chopped up pretty bad before they got there. But when we turned the Germans over to the Americans, we just marched them into an area. They threw their guns on a pile and marched them into an area and marched us around them, and that was the end of it. And then we went to a bridge. This is at Elberfeld. Went to a bridge, and half of the bridge had been bombed. We went on pylons, an American Jeep, a soldier in a Jeep, and he's handing us cigarettes, and we cried. That was the moment of freedom. We just stood there and cried. Grown men, I'll never forget that.
And you talked about being 145 pounds and down to under 100 pounds, wasting away. And I imagine there was a little bit of food for you once you were free again, too. Did you take it easy, or did you go a little too fast?
This is another most funny thing. We found a U.S. A truck that it was a kitchen truck. They were cooking food under and so forth. Thick pieces of fresh white bread. They just baked them. They baked them themselves. They smeared butter on them for it, and they gave us marmalade about that thick. And we ate it. And 5 minutes, I'd go over and puke it out. And we'd go back to the kitchen and do the same thing over again. Our stomach just couldn't handle it, and we'd just puke it out. Hunger's a terrible thing. That was the one thing that we were afraid of dying, was by hunger. We weren't afraid of the Germans killing us or hurting us or the Russians. We were afraid we would die of hunger because we didn't have anything to eat. And we would go, I remember the week before Easter that year, 45, we went a whole week without anything, not a thing to eat. And the Germans were still marching us back and forth. They didn't know what to do. Back and forth, we marched. And we wouldn't have anything to eat, not even because we're in the same place day by day. We had eaten it all up beforehand. There was nothing else to eat. And I mean, that was tough. You get to the point where you have to have water. Sometimes you had to worry about the water. In fact, I had to meet a dysentery when I got home. That's where I get from the drinking of water. You're not going to die of hunger.
Well, and when you bring that up, it makes me wonder how you see food since being a prisoner is different than maybe before being a prisoner. I bet that's true for a lot of things in life, that your perspective has been altered by the time you spent as a prisoner of the Germans. How do you see that impact in your life, of how that changed the way you see things?
I think it made me more tolerant, taught me patience, which I didn't have before, and tolerance, and you put up with it, learn to live with it, shut up and take it. That was the attitude, sort of. I think that's one thing I learned that I didn't have before. I learned to be more tolerant. I can put up with some things that other people wouldn't put up with.
What about coming back home to the States? What was it like to see American soil again?
It was just like it should be. They put us in a camp on the coast of France. Oh, funny thing. Here we're at this airfield, German airfield, and this is just before the end of the war, but they're flying C-47s in there and carrying us back. They had thousands of us there. This plane comes up, and we stood there and wouldn't get in the plane. The sergeant said, "Get in there." I said, "We ain't getting that airplane without a parachute." And we said, "Oh, what the hell?" So finally, this young lady comes out in her blue uniform, a WASP pilot. Yeah. She says, "Sergeant, get these men on board. We got to get the hell out of here." "Yes, ma'am." We all climbed aboard without another question. We landed in France. We ate 6 and 8 times a day, very bland food, to try to get our stomachs back to where we should be. We had very good care by the medical people. And if you had any problems, you go see the doctor. I mean, they were right there for you if you had to. Oh, funny little story. They marched us all, 6,000 of us, down the road about 3 miles where there was a landing strip. And pretty quick, this airplane comes rolling up. Gabreski, he had been a prisoner for 2 months.
Yeah.
And he says, "Now we got to get out there. We got to beat those Japs." You could have heard a pin drop. You couldn't have heard. There was not a sound. I don't know who put him up to it. I know he didn't do it on his own. Some general said, "You do that," because he would have done it on his own. But you couldn't have heard more silence. And nobody says, "I'm going to go on to Japan and beat those battles." No way. No, I wasn't the right crowd for that. Been there, done that.
Was it emotional to see your parents again?
More emotional for them than for me. My mother just hugged me and cried. And I wasn't crying. I was just glad to be there. But she was crying. And, she was hugging me. So, because remember, they had not known about where I was for 3 months. That's a pretty long time. The story about that. My father was a minister. He had visited a couple little old ladies that were members of his congregation. And he got to leave. They had a little bit of prayer. And then they said, "Pastor, would you like a cup of coffee?" "No coffee." How about a cup of tea? No, no tea. How about a glass of milk? No milk. And they looked at each other and said, how about a bourbon water? He said, no water.
That's a good one. Well, I know we've covered quite a bit, and if there's anything else you want to add, feel free. But I just want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us what you went through, because it reminds us how much we take for granted and how much we need to be thankful for what we have. As we wrap up, what would you say all these years later, the life that you almost didn't have with everything you went through, what are you most thankful for now at 91 years old?
My health. I smoked for 50 years, and now I have emphysema, but at least I don't have lung cancer. So that's one thing I'm thankful for. Otherwise, I'm in pretty good shape. I have no major problems of any kind health-wise, except that emphysema. So I'm looking for a couple more years to be around. And our kids are growing up fine, nicely, and we're having we have a son and daughter, both live in Tuscadero. Our oldest son lives still in San Jose.
Have you ever stopped and thought, never would have met your wife, never would have had kids or grandkids or great-grandkids if something went a little different back in Europe in World War II?
I always laugh at this, because when I came back, I had been with the Bank of America for about 2 years at that time. I came back and went right to the bank, went right to work. But then I had to marry my wife to get my job back. I always kid her about that, because she was working for the bank then. So I had to marry her to get my job back.
I guess the last thing I'd like to ask you, when you think about kids today who don't know a whole lot about World War II, you know quite a bit. You know what you went through. You saw others who didn't get to come home from the war. What is it that you hope is remembered about you and all the guys like you who fought and won that war?
I don't think any of us were heroes. We were survivors. We did what we had to do. The soldiers that go today are mostly enlistees. They enlist, but they're treated totally different than we were at the time, because ours was a good war, if you will. It was we had to do it. It had to be done. It had to be done now. When I see the soldiers and talk to the soldiers today about how there are all sorts of other kind of problems that they have, I feel sorry for them, because they're still struggling to find a way to accept this, to live with it. And it's as I said, we did it because we had to. It was there and it had to be done, and we didn't have any choice. I think it makes a big difference that we were treated very well when we got back.
Do you feel like what you did was important?
Yes. Even though I was only one of how many million, I had to do it, and I'm glad I did.
Well, I'm glad we had a chance to listen to just some of your stories today. What you endured for our country, for the sake of our freedom, is really remarkable. Thank you, Carl Heuser. I have some photos of Carl then and now, and even the plane, his plane, being shot out of the sky. Those are posted on Facebook. All you have to do is type in Hometown Heroes Radio. Hometown Heroes Radio. When you go to Facebook, you'll find all of that. Carl supported the Estrella Warbirds Museum in Paso Robles from its beginning, and maybe you'll catch him out there for the big Warbirds Over Paso air show coming up October 5th. They're going to have a P-51 Mustang flying, among other vintage planes. And that's a great place to visit, even when there isn't an air show happening. Some really neat things to see there. Next week, we're going to hear from a Navy man in Tulare who has a unique connection to a significant moment in World War II. I look forward to sharing that story with you. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. After hearing Carl talk about living in the absence of freedom and surviving that brutal 600-mile death march over 88 days when hundreds and hundreds of his fellow prisoners died, I think we've all been reminded again of the heavy price that has been paid on our behalf. And hopefully we understand even more now that freedom is not free.